Hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on the zero emission and electric future that we all hope for. Each week I'm joined by one of the wonderful EV Cafe crew, and this week, no exception, we've got the wonderful John Curtis. Welcome, John.
Hello, darlings. Are you all well?
Well, let's hope so, let's hope so. But every week we are joined by an innovator, pioneer and collaborator from within our industry. And today is no exception. We have got the wonderful Rob Durbin from Churchill Expert. Wonderful. Welcome, Rob.
Good morning, both. Good morning.
Rob, thank you so much for joining us. It's really exciting to be joined by somebody that knows a subject that very few of us know anything about. It's the dark art of underwriting, and we'll get to know a lot more about that and what that means within the context of Churchill and insurance, the Churchill Expert organization, part of course, the Direct Line Group. But I'm intrigued. What got you into photography?
Photography, okay. Yeah, yeah. So someone's obviously done their research. I have a university degree in fine art photography. In honesty, I was never particularly academic in school. I have dyslexia. Growing up in the 90s, early noughties, in school, probably worse so when you two were at school, I would imagine. Dyslexia wasn't really kind of, you know, not a lot of help going on for dyslexia. It didn't help that my parents didn't actually diagnose me as a child, even though they knew that I was dyslexic. I didn't get that diagnosis until I was at university. But, yeah, it's kind of never very academic, although very arty, I guess, growing up. My dad had a keen interest in photography. My granddad did as well. So I'd always been using cameras from a young age. And in all honesty, I went into A-levels. I did photography and I got an A grade. And I'd never got an A grade before in anything. So I thought, I must be all right at it. I'll take that on to university then. So that's what I did. And yeah, I ended up in Newport, South Wales. Because I was planning to do a foundation year, which is typically what you do. If you're going to go do art at university, you do a foundation year after sixth form to kind of, I don't know, it's like a tee you up for art university. But I got offered a very late place at Newport and I thought, well, save myself a year. I'll just crack on and start the university course without the foundation year. So off I went. But yeah, that's that really. But obviously,
oh, fantastic.
Photography, a great precursor to the insurance industry.
Well, that was the interesting thing for me because, I mean, it's great to hear that. And and what I love about, you know, doing these little bits of research and asking questions that are a little bit left field as to a start point, and suddenly we get a glimpse of those formative years of Rob. It must have actually been quite tough at school because I mean, listen, I know what it's like to not be doing, you know, perhaps as good as you could do if you had the right support and help, or just being like a square peg in a round hole in school. It was a shocker for me. I spent most of it not in school. So how was school life for you? And I mean, did that sort of give you any sort of the foundations of your future life?
I think what I would say is I never struggled, really struggled, you know, at school, but then I never really excelled. I was very much the middle of the road. But I think dealing with my dyslexia and come to terms with how to navigate that landscape for me and get the best results I could from school, I guess, taught me a lot about myself and determination and things like that. I mean, there's a whole myriad of things that go on when you're that sort of age that kind of improve and kind of build you as a person. But I think, you know, I was never, you know, never excelled at anything until, you know, arguably photography. Never really did particularly poorly at things. I think the worst grades I got in GCSE were D's, which is by no stretch of the imagination terrible, really. but I didn't fail anything, that's for sure. So, you know, I think, yeah, it just it was an interesting time. But I did enough to go on to A levels. I did enough to go on to university, and even at university, I wouldn't say I excelled either. You know, I think I came away with a 2-2 or something like that. So, you know, nothing particularly special, but you know, I got a lot of memories and a lot of experience and time that I think was valuable.
Mm. Well, it sounds like, you know, as you say, navigating the difficulties prepares as well, right? For particularly for corporate life. Because corporate life can be a very challenging, why I've left it, as well, you know, it can be quite a challenging sort of navigational period, can't it? It's and I see that you've spent a long, I mean, you started out as a salesman for game, I think, right?
Yeah. So I'll be honest, that game job, you know. The reality is the career, well, not the career, sorry, the course that I did was a fine art photography course. To be considered successful in after taking on that course was to basically become a gallery artist. And that's not a particularly, you know, unless you crack the scene and you're one in a very large pond, you're not going to make any money, real money from it. And by the end of the course, I kind of was very disillusioned with that world, and kind of knew that that wasn't something that I was going to kind of commit to. So I was working part-time at Game in Cardiff whilst I was at university. I managed to take that job back to Bristol, where I'm from, and I worked for a period at Game, basically just post-university. Didn't really have any job prospects having come out of university, like a lot of people might do. It would be slightly more, should we say, more academic sort of degrees. You know, you can't walk into a 30, 40 grand a year job on a photography degree. So I really did kind of start at the bottom, working as, I think I moved back to Bristol and I was working 40 hours a week on minimum wage on a 4-hour contract. So, you know, it was tough going. I mean, we don't have to get into it too much, but at the time, my wife, now wife, was pregnant as well. So I kind of had a lot going on that time.
So let me just understand this, Rob. Fine art photography is where you are employed to take photographs of the amazing works of art by Monet and Gauguin, whoever. No.
So you are an artist and your medium is photography, essentially.
Ah, I'm with you. So you take great photos.
I like to think I take great photos. I will say my wife is better at it and she has her own photography business, small photography business. But I mean, you're talking about artists like Andreas Gursky, you might have heard of, you know. Oh, I'm looking around looking for names now because I can't remember any off the top of my head. But Paul C. Wright is another one, British photographer. So those are individuals who, you know, they are artists or in some cases more documentarians who use the camera as their canvas, as it were.
So that's a heck of a leap to go from a very creative and wonderful way of expressing the inner you into underwriting. How on earth did you make that? You know, you worked in retail to keep the wolf from the door, and I think Tesla, but underwriting, I'm a lawyer by training, and I imagine that, you know, like me, there's an awful lot of sitting down, writing, understanding statistics and the context within which you insure people. That's a heck of a leap. Talk us through that.
So, yeah, I mean, I was in Game for a period. I left there and joined Best Buy, a big American electrical firm. They tried to break the UK, what would have been about 13 years ago, tried to take on Currys at their own game, and ultimately pulled the plug on that. And I was left in a position of being made redundant from that role. I needed a job, and I found a service sales job working for RBS at the time. And I just applied for it. It was very much a shotgun approach at that point in time, in terms of I need a job. I've got a bit of sales know-how. Let's just, you know, apply that to a telephony based role. So I did the interview. It was one of those interviews where I was actually told in the interview that I was successful, which is always nice to know. I think that was the one and only time. But so took on a service sales job in what was a fairly embryonic direct line for business. And that was around the time that RBS had to relinquish the direct line business, and Direct Line Group was formed. So very quickly, although I am, you know, an artistic or creative person, I do have a fondness for detail as well, and understanding detail, and being that person that people look to for knowledge. I quite like that element. And I did spend a bit of time actually whilst I was at Best Buy. I worked in the photography department, which was the callback there. They appreciated having someone who knew their way around a camera. And what I did do there actually was set up some photography courses for customers to purchase and be taught how to use a camera, because there was a lot of people at that point in time. It was kind of the rise of the DSLR. You know, people were coming from compact cameras to using a DSLR, and then kind of hitting a wall in terms of, well, what's a shutter speed? What's an aperture? Because they didn't necessarily grow up with the SLRs of the analog period. So it was, and having that fundamental knowledge, and I'll be honest with you, that was where my expertise, probably a strong word, but my strong points were with photography. It was more about understanding the settings and how they all work and fit together, and the detail of the story. Very much the kind of practical side of photography, more so than the creative side. So I would argue I don't really have an eye for photography. My wife definitely has the eye, but she won't know what to do sometimes with the settings, so I'll be like, here we go. Yeah, exactly. So I put together these training packs for people and delivered them and did all sorts with that. But that's a roundabout way of, so kind of bringing that into working in an insurance environment, and then having to look at insurance policies and endorsements. And there was definitely a transferable element of what I've been doing previously to insurance. And very quickly, I understood, I found enjoyment and certainly, wanted to grow that burgeoning sort of interest in that side of things. And that coincided actually quite well with what was going on in Direct Line Group at the time. So very quickly, I understood that, you know, I talked to peers and people, leaders around me, and they said, you know, what you're interested in is, you know, sensibly, it's kind of underwriting, it sounds like. That's what you want to get into. And we did have some underwriters in D-Alpha-B, but they were kind of these mythical beings at the end of a telephone that you never really saw. You knew their names, but, you know, you knew if you had to call one, you know, you had to be on your game. So I ended up spending a bit of time with them, actually. But at the time, there was a restructure within NIG, which is part of the Direct Line Group, which is the broker-facing side of things. And there's a whole shake-up. And essentially, within Bristol and Manchester, they created underwriting centres. And I was able to get a role as an underwriter working within the Watford regional team on existing business. So that kind of was my start in underwriting I came in as an assistant underwriter, working within the region, supporting existing business. And I came in completely, I mean, I knew the DL4B products, which were essentially package direct products. When you're talking about complex commercial insurance, talking about commercial combined and then motor traders combined, you know, I was dealing with, you know, professional liability policies for tradesmen, one-man band tradesmen, probably averaging, you know, £200 premiums. So then going to dealing with motor traders averaging £5,000 premiums, it was a big learning curve, really big learning curve. And but I stuck with it, and you know, I spent 8 years in NIG, working my way from being a assistant underwriter right up to ostensibly being the main motor underwriter within that Watford team within the Bristol region. The Watford region within Bristol. It was a weird setup. I went from having authority level of a 1 to a 5, which is the same as kind of a regional manager level. And just always wanted to progress, always wanted to learn, to provide myself with more knowledge and autonomy in decision making and things like that. Spent a lot of time working with our head office teams as well to gain more experience. So that kind of brings me up to about 2.5 years ago when I took this role. So as you said, I think at the start, so my role now is EV and flexible fleet underwriter not to correct you too much, Paul, but you said I work within Churchill Expert, which isn't entirely true. So
yeah, I wondered if I got that wrong.
That's right. No worries. I do work, you know, very closely with Churchill Expert and the guys over there with Nikki and the team. Mm. But my role stretches across the whole of our commercial businesses. So I actually work a lot within NIG still. So although I'm not employed by NIG, I still spend a lot of time supporting their side of things as well. So what my focus is really is being able to offer EV underwriting expertise. And when we talk about flexible fleet, we talk about usership of vehicle models. So not a case of, you know, a company A buying vehicle B and then going on with it. We're talking about, you know, subscriptions. We're talking about salary sacrifice. We're talking about midterm hire, peer-to-peer potentially as well. So those propositions, from a commercial point of view, we've got two channels that can kind of cover off most markets, in that we have the Churchill Expert brand, which works directly with partners, and we have the NIG brand that works through brokers, it for a more, I guess, traditional commercial insurance avenue. And then rather than being within the NIG Watford region where I was before, I'm dealing with all the regions within NIG. So they can be, whereas a Churchill Expert is one entity within that, I had to deal with a whole myriad of different people over on the NIG side. And I kind of sit in this weird space. Some people like to call me a floater. I don't necessarily agree with that term, but
rude.
I kind of sit in this weird space between our head office underwriters and kind of the rest of the business. So I do report into our head office from an underwriting point of view, but then I kind of deal a lot with the kind of column that Nikki works in Churchill Expert, and Ian Exworth, I think you've met as well in the past. I don't know if that's me. I feel like I'm waffling a bit, but I don't know if that's giving you a good.
Rob, you're not. it's really. I mean, it's super interesting. It's funny you refer to underwriters as mythical beasts. I mean, absolutely. It's funny because I a different underwriter, but sort of financial underwriters, having lived and worked in the motor industry for many, many years. There is a different kind of finance underwriter, and they were always I don't know, the ones that had all the power, because they would sort of, you know, be the ones able to say yes or no, or, you know, okay, go on then, if we'll take a bank statement or a director's guarantee or a different, you know, different things in order to move things forward. So it's kind of that sales negotiation. It's a bit of that kind of creative thing as well, being able to see beyond what you can see and sort of bring the best out of it.
Can I ask a question, Paul? Can I just clarify what underwriting is? Because I guess there are going to be people who, you know, we kind of work in this industry. There'll be people who are listening who are thinking, I know it's insurance, but what do underwriters actually do? Can you give
That's
us a
very fair question.
A brief example of the sort of thing you deal with?
Seriously, it is a good question. I don't think I've ever had to specifically... I've probably got 5 minutes into it with my wife, she's fallen asleep, but...
with what? Explaining underwriting?
Yes, and insurance.
Oh, right, checking. Okay. Yeah. Just checking. I wasn't sure what you got into.
So I think the best way of putting it is, so ultimately we kind of sit in a position where we have support from the likes of actuaries and pricing teams. So they kind of are the ones who put prices onto things. What I do, or what an underwriter will do essentially, is now a lot of what an underwriter does these days, especially within a personal lines environment, will be kind of algorithmically, associated. So it would be about assessing the risk that's in front of you, and the risk being, you know, who the driver is, where they live, what their credit history is, what type of use of the vehicle they're doing, what the business that there is, you know, what the vehicle is, you know, and all those sorts of factors will build up a picture of how you want to view the risk and ultimately put a price on it. And then obviously, so within a personal line space or a package space, shall we say, it's very much a square shape fitting into a square hole. You kind of have to be the archetypal sort of, or fit into their kind of shape to get a price. Mm-hmm. Within a complex commercial insurance space, it's very much of case of, well, this is the insured, this is how they're being presented. There's a question, first of all, is it within the company's appetite? Do we want to take on that risk? Is it, and then it's about, well, how do we then fit it in and price it? And then, you know, do we tweak endorsements? You know, we might have, I mean, there's a whole myriad of a library of different things you can do. But I think what I certainly appreciate about the space is having the experience and the autonomy and being empowered to kind of make those assessments of risk and make decisions. And ultimately where I've got to now is actually make a decision. And what I've always wanted to do is kind of break down those barriers of decision. Because, you know, Paul mentioned about, and I mentioned earlier about those underwriters at the end of the phone, what you didn't necessarily see when you were talking to those underwriters is they have their own kind of route to make a decision as well. So, you know, we have very strict underwriting authority, is what it's called, in terms of how much decision-making power you have. And ultimately, I've expanded that to a point where, you know, I'm fairly confident I can make my own decisions, and, you know, I operate within that, and it's all... acceptable, shall we say.
So I suppose there's a musical analogy here that's kind of, ordinarily with a personal insurance which fits into that square box, you're a student who plays music very much to the notes that were written by the composer. You are a conductor who is taking a complex range of factors, and you are making the different elements of that orchestra that's in front of you, the risk, the appetite for risk, the person that you're insuring, and you're making value judgments based on your experience to bring out the best in insurance to support that person. So you're making your own sweet music.
I like that analogy. I might use that in the future.
That is a really good analogy. And it was, I think, when we spoke, Rob, because, of course, Churchill Expert in Shawmee, and I wasn't a straightforward policy.
Obviously
in
high
some
risk
respects.
High client.
Yes, but not beyond Rob's capabilities. That's what we like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, we're very straightforward, so don't worry about it.
There you go. Well, that was. but it was important to kind of understand, you know, like what were the factors, and you were able to articulate that really nicely for me, just kind of showing me that, you know, if you've got somebody wanting to go on the policy that's going to have a few more points than you, it'll increase the risk, or the age profile was something that was more extreme, then it could change the balance of the policy and push the price up. And I guess, you know, it's the appetite of the business, but also the insight, the wisdom that you're applying personally, and you've got to that place. And I think that's brought us really nicely to the beginning of this journey, because you're now looking at something that is very much future focused. It's got very, very little history around it. Yeah. So, of course, a lot of underwriting is a lot about experience and history, right? You know, the history repeating itself. These are the things that happened when that happened before. But now we're looking at EVs that have got acceleration that's off the scale, and we're putting vehicles in the hands of people that have never experienced acceleration like it. They don't even sound like they're on when they're on. You know, but on the flip side, they're much smoother, they're much simpler to drive, and then again, you've got the cost of a battery. What kind of impact's going to, and so on. And we've got subscription models now, where insurance is being included in that. And I'm also a recipient of one of those models as well, which I know Churchill Expert insure. So, talk to me about how you're able to bring that foresight, that knowledge, and look at this industry. And what do you see that's really unique about the EV industry, and there's the challenges, but also the benefits?
A lot there. So I think...
Yes, sorry.
So I think you're quite right that the insurance industry is based predominantly on data and experience. And where we've been with ICE vehicles is that we've got, you know, arguably 100 years worth of experience dealing with combustion engines. Obviously, cars have changed, and engines have changed, laws on the road have changed, you know, all those sorts of things have kind of come and gone and changed. But what we do have, you know, NIG being an insurer that is over 100 years old, and Direct Line as a personal insurance provider since the 80s, you know, there's a lot of experience and book there. And then you come to something like EV, which is a completely new technology. And I think what you've seen in the market is a general hesitancy in coming to EVs, because there's no data. You know, how do you accurately underwrite a risk with no knowledge of the risk? And you have to take a little bit of a leap of faith. And certainly within Direct Line, our approach from day one with EVs is, I think, maybe at the very beginning there was hesitancy, but when it became very clear that this was the future and this is where we're going, you know, I think that, well, we'll say the previous mandate of 2030 for EVs, that was very much an impetus to say, well, why would we be declining these sorts of vehicles? We need to, ultimately, we need to be insuring them to put ourselves in a better position down the line to have that experience. If we keep saying no, then we're never going to have the experience. So I think as a group from day one, especially when Tesla entered the UK, we've been Tesla's sort of insurer of choice since day one. So we have a lot of experience within the Tesla book of business. But ultimately as well, what we've been doing is saying yes to other vehicles as and when they've come along. Now, there's learnings that we've got from that, definitely. There's a lot of learnings that we've got from flexible fleet or the usership market, because what we are seeing is it does operate and act very differently to personal lines and the commercial fleet, but it's kind of somewhere in the middle, because what you've got essentially with a lot of these businesses is that you have, the reason I deal with it as a commercial insurer is because you have an entity, a business, who is in control of the vehicle. So be it, I'll use a company like Elmo, for example. So they are the company, they are in control of those vehicles, and they have a customer who's driving that vehicle. But then you have then a situation where the end user of the vehicle is more of a personal lines risk than a commercial risk. It's about melding the two together and understanding something completely new. So what we've done actually is to kind of, you know, change and mold with the market and the way business is going in this space to have a completely new pricing proposition and underwriting proposition specifically for these risks. So we're not using, you know, the same personal lines journey that you would see when you go and go compare or anything like that. But also we're not using the same quoting process that only takes maybe 3-4 data points for a commercial fleet policy. So we are positioning ourselves somewhere in the middle and optimizing ourselves in there. And the way that we are positioning this business is very much built on data. So wherever we can, we try and get as much data around the vehicles and the customers when they come out of it, not only to improve or make our pricing more accurate in the future, but also to make a far more competitive and compelling product and pricing model for our customers as well.
It's a big task, isn't it? To I mean, it kind of feels like you've got to boil the ocean every time that you sort of approach a new set of things. How do you feel that the insurance market is coping as a whole, but also with yourselves with the new technology? Or are there trends emerging that are either positive or negative?
So there are trends, definitely. You know, I think I wouldn't be, you know, too surprised to tell you that EVs are more expensive to repair at the moment. Mm-hmm. Because of that, they have an inherent higher premium associated with them. You know, mm-hmm. taking windscreen claims, for example, you know, based on some of our own research, you're talking about 100% more expensive to repair a windscreen on an EV because of rather than an ICE vehicle. A lot of that is to do with the technologies that are with an EV vehicle. Mm-hmm. It is easier for a OEM, a vehicle manufacturer, to implement technologies into an EV vehicle because of the way that the engine operates and works than it is in an ICE vehicle. You know, I was listening to Tom Laurie Fussy from LexisNexis the other day, and he was talking about something that I didn't perhaps necessarily realize, that when you have these vehicles with automatic braking, or you know, when you're going fast and you're going to hit something sort of thing, and you have that brake that implements, in an ICE vehicle, that brake pedal has to physically be pressed down for that to be implemented. There's no other way of implementing that braking process other than physically pushing that brake down. In an EV, you don't have to touch the pedal. That can just be put into the motor, working the motor in reverse, rather than actually physically pressing that pedal. So the implementation of technologies like that is just simpler in an EV. I mean, I appreciate I've kind of gone way off piece in terms of why windscreen claims are more expensive, but, you know, what we're seeing as well, you know, at the moment, is the industry as a whole is struggling in claims inflation, specifically in the market. I don't know if you two follow much of the insurance press. I wouldn't blame you if you didn't. But, you know,
funnily enough,
but what we're seeing as an industry is that the cost of motor claims at the moment is as high as it's ever been. And unfortunately, you know, an insurance company, much to the many people's priority, is that they're not, that we're not a charity. We are trying to earn a profit, and we are a business that has to stay afloat. So when there is inflationary aspects, not only, and I'm not talking about, you know, the pound inflating, I'm talking about the cost of repairing a vehicle is increasing dramatically. That unfortunately comes down onto the premium payers, and those prices will go up, because otherwise these companies, ourselves and other motor insurance companies, just won't be able to operate, won't be in business. And I think that is, you know, that is coupled with the EV situation, with lack of information and data. But what we are doing certainly is we're looking regularly doing sort of audits and reviews on how things are working. So without going too much into detail, because I'm not sure how much we want to share as a business, but you know, it's been widely considered for a long time that Teslas are quite expensive to repair. I can tell you they're not the most expensive to repair from our point of view. There are other OEMs out there that are more expensive, but we're still in a position, you know, that we are only 2-3 years or potentially into this journey. You know, Salary Sacrifice is a massively expanding area of business, which is 100% EVs, which is brilliant. You know, the growth in that area for us as a business is astronomical. It's the biggest growth area within commercial across the whole business. But you're only getting to the point now that people are handing back their first vehicle. You know, the Tesla Model 3 is only just coming back around to that 3-year period where people are handing them back and they're going into a second-hand market. And 3 years is not enough to have, you know, really concrete history in this space. So it is a learning journey. And, you know, it's very much the case with, you know, you look at the cost of EVs at the moment, and the kind of market that they, or the position within the market with the models that you have, you know, the market EV is crying out for a compact, affordable EV. Arguably the MG4 sits in that, but it's still probably too expensive for most. And really what you're seeing is vehicles in that sort of 30 to 50K area. So not only will our experience grow, but technology will improve, the price of technology will improve. Yeah. I mean, guys, I think I was only listening to a podcast the other day. They were talking about when the Macintosh Lisa was released, and it was about $50,000 on the market at the time. So, and you know, a computer in the 90s would easily cost you thousands of pounds. But now, you know, we all carry supercomputers in our pocket. So it will, in time, things will improve. But what we're not very good at as a society at the moment is patience with these sorts of things. And, you know, we only have ourselves to blame with that, I think. But, you know, and it doesn't help, there's other factors going on in the background, the financial crisis and all this, that and the other. But, you know, I think it's a positive future. And it's funny, you know, talking about EVs, and they are seemingly the catalyst to this usership model of not car ownership, but usership, isn't it? Because you don't own the car. So in that, you're going to have people who, you know, I was saying the other day, I don't own a car. I have a car. I don't own it. I don't think I ever will own a car now. You know, I had a secondhand Skoda for a bit. I sold it a year ago. I don't think I'll ever buy a car again. It'll always be on some sort of subscription or usership-based model.
That, isn't it? Because all three of us are in the same boat. I have one from Elmo. Paul has a subscription car as well.
Baltric,
change as a result of not owning the vehicle, so they might take more risks, or that they look after it better because they might have to give it back in a month's time. Are there changes in how we're using our vehicles that you've noticed?
Yes. It's still early doors in terms of, you know, we can certainly take what we see here and make hypotheses about driver behavior. One of the things we are seeing, especially within the salary sacrifice market, is that, you know, individuals have that vehicle for 3-4 years. So ultimately, they treat it the same as if they owned the vehicle. Mm. Because what we're looking at it from a point of view is that we have propositions and we have written self-drive hire risks in the past. They notoriously run poorly because you have individuals getting into vehicles that, you know, they've only got it for a day, two maybe. Mm. You know, my colleague who I report into in underwriting, his favourite comment is the fastest car you'll ever have is a hire car. because, you know, you don't care what you do with it ultimately. You throw it around for a day or two, use it for what you need it for, and then hand it back. And that has shown in the kind of the loss for those vehicles. But there's definitely, but then there's also an angle to this usership-based model of insurance and what we deal with in terms of how you get those customers through the door as well. So we do ultimately do some short-term hire stuff. But it's the onboarding process and the ways in which those companies assess their customers prior to them taking vehicles out, which is a lot more different to, you know, the old school man behind a desk, as a quick look at your license, sign that bit of paper, off you go. It's about, you know, doing proper identity checks, credit checks, affordability checks, you know, really going to the nth degree to make it so that person taking that vehicle has a skin in the game, ultimately, at the end of the day. And, you know, be it that there are propositions in the market that say, oh, you can have a vehicle for 30 days and hand it back. You know, Onto did that, RIP. But, you know, what we see is that very few customers are actually taking it for 30 days. I think the average we see is about 9-10 months that people have a vehicle for. And people look after those vehicles. And I think kind of swinging back around to EVs is that a lot of the catalysts for these types of propositions are EVs as well. And there's a benefit to EVs being in these propositions because it gives customers and consumers a means to use and test EVs and learn about them to then go on and get their own vehicles. And it kind of does a lot to kind of disparage a lot of the, frankly, rubbish that you see in the market around EVs and how they run and operate. And, you know, funnily enough, they don't all burst into flames.
It's not true. No, it is true. It is. They don't all burst into flames, and that's, it is really good. I think
it's important to note that we've not had one EV burst into flames.
Wow. That's, and given that the way that you've led with Tesla and with subscription models and with salary sacrifice insurance, you have got a lot of experience with electric vehicles. I don't know, and I'm sure nobody will be able to say whether it's the most in the marketplace, but you certainly got a significant experience of electric vehicles, and you heard it here first.
I think you have to be very careful about saying you're the best at anything in our industry, but... Well, has he got the FCA knocking at his door?
Probably.
No.
So, no. But, We've certainly got the lion's share, certainly from a flexible fleet point of view, we have the lion's share in the UK, I would say. Tesla, we have a very high proportion of Teslas on the UK road are insured by Direct Line. Mm-hmm. I feel like I should also just quickly preface that my comment about no cars bursting into flame is from a commercial point of view. So I don't want to be fact-checked and told that I'm... Actually, we did have one, you know, owned by Bob down in Torquay on Direct Line.
Yeah.
So
Rob, I mean, it's been an interesting time, and probably, I mean, I love and often quote the Justin Trudeau quote that he said that the pace of change has never been so fast, and it will never be as slow again. And it's a great, you know, we're on a J curve, aren't we? And so it leads me to think, you know, what does the future look like, both for Rob, but also for this industry? And what do you believe for yourself now, really? What does success look like over the next few years?
So it's an interesting time for where I work at the moment. It was recently announced that all of Direct Line's commercial businesses will be purchased by the Intact Group, so RSA. So we will be, you know, I mean, subject to shareholder votes and all that, but you know, in theory, we'll be moving to a new home come next year. But at the moment, it looks like that home will be commercially focused in its entirety. So what I really want to do is kind of, you know, I came into this space. We had one partner in Cazoo and a little bit of salary sacrifice that was very embryonic. And probably with a gross written premium of about 2 million, somewhere around there. And I was kind of tasked with, well, Rob, you go in there, you wrap your arms around this and grow it and see where we go. You know, we're now looking at probably 12 million. In about the space of 2 years. So, you know, I talk again about that salary sacrifice being a huge growth area. I think what I want to do is to continue that growth. You know, there is certain things in the future around salary sacrifice. You know, there is a shelf life at the moment. You know, we've only got that reduced benefit in kind until 2028 at the moment. Given he's not back that deadline by 5 years, I'd like to think that continues in that direction. You know, what I would want to see is kind of, I think success is growing this book of business into another pillar of the kind of commercial book. You know, we've obviously got products like Commercial Combined Fleet, MetaTrade. They've been around for donkeys. They're well-established products. I think what I'd like to see is Flexible Fleet get into that similar sort of conversation. You know, it's no longer a niche, weird thing that only Rob does over in the corner. But I have a team that work under me, you know, and we're kind of held up there with the other classes of business within the business.
Brilliant. Final question from me, Rob, is if you had a magic wand and you could wave it to grant yourself one wish, whether it be a personal wish or a business wish, what would that be?
I don't know. Financial stability?
Personally or in the business?
Both.
Interesting.
I think if I'm being honest at the moment, you know, what I'm doing in this space is very much, it's not off the side of my desk. This is what I'm doing, but it feels like it's off the side of the desk of the business as a whole. To a certain extent, we are committed and we have resource within it. But what I really want to see is us to really kick on with it and really get the kind of the green light on it and to be able to push on and get that investment and encouragement from a business point of view. And I'm hoping that will come in time. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of obvious why it hasn't been coming now. But, you know, I don't know if I'm being too candid now, but
love the idea of a green light. I think that's fabulous.
Yeah, I was there. I was right there with the green light. Absolutely.
So I think you know, and what I want to see is, I think, you know, as a society, what I would like us to do is move closer to that net zero future a lot quicker. I think the news this week is completely backwards. I don't really understand the methodology. I mean, I won't get too much into it, but, you know, I feel like for sake of my own children's futures and us as a society, we should be doing everything we can to, you know, that. I will bring up the adage of just stop burning stuff, you know. You know, we need to kind of move away from that. We need to do more. And, you know, we've got an individual at the kind of head of our political system that's kind of saying we want to lead, and doing everything antithetical to that.
Yeah. What is it? There's a great, so, you know, anyway, basically what you're saying and what you're doing are the opposite, and it cancels out. I mean, both the actions and the words from our beloved Prime Minister, or not so beloved in my world, are just opposite to what everybody else thinks is common sense. But anyway, we won't talk about that. It's a moment in time. You know what, Rob? It's been fantastic. We've learned a lot of things. And one thing that we at the EV Cafe desperately need from you is some really good photographs, because our photographs are rubbish. So whether you or your wife could turn up to Fleet Mobility Live, please, with your camera and just, you know, get a decent shot, because I mean, you know, you're gonna have to be creative, and then it might need to be a filter or two for John and I, because the other three are the good looking ones. You know, we'd love that, but also for the insight that you've brought us today around this journey that we're on to, well, with technology coming into vehicles that is much more expensive, much longer to repair, probably problems around parts and availability. Who knew about windscreens being more expensive to replace or repair? All of these things, I mean, because we,
the topic of the influx of Chinese manufacturers that are going to be coming into the UK, and, you know, I can go off again, but, you know, you're talking about dealing with the same OEMs for 30 years, and then you've got a whole handful of new OEMs with no relationships with them, with no infrastructure for bringing in parts and technology.
It's a really difficult time, and I think if anybody takes anything away from today, it's that insurance is going up, but it's not going up just because insurers want to make more money. It's because the effective risk in a period of transition is that much higher than it was, and we're establishing lots of new things, and everything is that little bit more expensive at the beginning, and it's why we want to move this forward with fleets and with new types of model, because we want to be able to get all of these vehicles and all of this experience down so that people that are at the poorest end, and this is the fact, you know, that we hear that we're trying to look after the poorest, so we'll just defer it for another little while, and actually that's going to make all the difference. No, it's not. It's just going to prolong the challenge. It's going to prolong the difference. And what we need to do is get used vehicles through. Anyway, it's been brilliant. It's been really insightful. And I hope people will take that away and understand and be patient with this process and these increased, increased premiums, but recognizing that often the electric vehicle is simpler to drive and therefore probably at less risk of going wrong or being in an accident, but just more expensive when it gets there because we're reliant on other people in the road. So, Rob, listen, it's been a real pleasure. Genuinely, our pleasure. We're really grateful to Churchill Expert for all of the support that you give us But you're giving the whole industry in the transition to EV, being leaders in Tesla, leaders in subscription, leaders in salary sacrifice. It's a brilliant business case that you're bringing to the market to enable us to move forward. So we're grateful. Rob, I'm sure many people would love to connect with you. I'm sure you're happy to receive a connection request on LinkedIn or two.
I will admit I'm pretty pants on LinkedIn, but I will do my best. My profile is probably a bit bare bones, but no definitely, if anyone wants to connect or have a conversation, then by all means. But it might take a day or two for me to reply.
That's fine. And of course, everybody, do head over to the website of Churchill, and do make sure that you don't just rely on comparison sites. Well, actually, the Direct Line doesn't matter now, is it? Direct Line Group don't, you know, they're not important anymore. Or are they? Who knows?
For the minute. I'll go on the record.
Yeah, okay. On the record, Direct Line are very important. But focus on Churchill Expert. Do check these guys out. They're leaders in the industry. And of course, if you want to listen to any of the other podcasts, do head over to our website, evcafe.org, and you will find a plethora of interesting conversation over there. Yes, I know, a big word, John. John, final thought from you?
Just brilliant to get some insight into what actually goes on behind the scenes. You know, we all think of insurance as that cost that we have to have. But to understand and have it broken down like that as to what the risks might be and why would anybody have an appetite to insure Paul Kirby, it's fascinating. So, Rob, thank you so much for that. Really appreciate that.
Anytime.
Rob, final thought from you?
No, just I mean, great to have the platform to be able to come on and speak about insurance and what I do and all the things that interest me, because sure as hell my wife doesn't like listening to it, so
are we fairly certain that she is not going to be one of the people tuning in to this episode?
Maybe if she needs to go to sleep.
Brilliant. Rob Durbin, Churchill Expert, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. John, always good to spend some time with you as well. Head over to the website, everybody, or check in with us on LinkedIn. But we look forward to chatting with you again soon. Have a great day.